This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Mukesh Kapila was at the top of his game. His international development work for the British Civil Service had earned him a CBE from the Queen. In 2002, he left the Civil Service and was made UN Special Advisor on Human Rights and later Kofi Annan's Special Representative to Afghanistan. In 2003, he was chosen to head the UN's largest field operation, its development and humanitarian programs in Sudan. But within months of his arrival in the capital Khartoum, Mukesh Kapila had a choice to make.
One of the perks of being a high UN official is to have a grand office, and I had one in Khartoum. Beautiful air-conditioned room, nice leather sofa, portraits of Kofi Annan on the wall, flags of the UN and Sudan and such like. It was a very, very hot afternoon, so hot that the rubber on our vehicles would melt. I was, after a nice diplomatic lunch, I was actually sitting having a doze, reading some papers, and there was a commotion outside, which I could even hear, even through my bulletproofed windows. My assistant, Mona, came in and said that there was this mad woman who was trying to see me, a young mad woman who was wanting to come and see me, and the guards had turned her away, but she was being persistent. So I said, of course, you'd let her in, and in walked this young woman in her 20s, and she refused to sit on my sofa, saying that her clothes were very dirty, she had come a long way, she had come from Darfur, and so she sat on the floor, and she spoke in Arabic. My assistant Muna translated. Basically, her story was that she had just come away after having been raped, not just herself raped, but also her mother and her sister and about 100 other women in her neighborhood. And they had been raped by a gang of soldiers, many of them in a Sudan government uniform. And she described the nature of the rapes that had taken place, the violence that had attended it. And these rapes were taking place in front of her father, her grandfather, bringing humiliation not just upon herself, which is bad enough, but frankly on the whole of the community. And she spoke in a slow, halting, soft voice. My very genteel assistant who was translating found it very, very difficult to do the translation, the words being used, the nature of the personal violations that had been committed. And getting the translation from Arabic into English is profoundly shocking as the story unfolded. And then she said that there were many other cases like that, and she would like to get this reported and investigated. That was one of the first direct reports, eyewitness account reports, personal reports of what was going on in Darfur. Enormous courage on her part to actually escape from there, as well as incredible courage to find her way across hundreds of miles to Khartoum, and then to have the courage to actually persist in coming to see me. And then, unfortunately, I made a mistake. I should really have really recognized how vulnerable she was, and we should have ensured her safety. But she wanted to go and meet with the rest of her family, and she left my building. And I, to this day, I'm very sorry that I let her go, because when the following day we wanted to trace her again to get her story more written down and witnessed and properly signed up by our human rights experts, we could never find out. I subsequently discovered that she had been picked up by the secret police, who were, of course, hanging around my office. And to this day, we don't know what's really happened to her.
Conflict was not a new phenomenon in Sudan. In fact, at this time, all eyes were focused on unrelated peace negotiations between the government and rebels in the south of the country. Meanwhile, in the West, the possibility of a racial dimension to events in Darfur was particularly worrying. The province of Darfur is mostly black African, while wider Sudan is Arab-dominated. Shortly before Mukesh's arrival in Sudan, rebel groups in Darfur had attacked government targets, some calling for independence, others simply for a fairer share of resources. There had been sketchy reports of a very brutal government response against the people of Darfur.
What this young woman said very clearly was that this terrorism was actually sponsored by the state. And indeed, there were Sudanese army helicopters hovering nearby and Sudanese police and so on providing support. And then she also described how the rapists were saying that they were trying to clean up the area, that she was a black woman who was subhuman, and really they would show them what could be done. What happened in subsequent days, including I saw for myself when I visited the region, that her story was unfortunately not unique, that virtually in every community affected by the conflict, this was a common experience. Women and young girls had been systematically taken away, brutally raped, and when their menfolk wanted to intervene, they were usually killed, and dead bodies were thrown into wells, and whole houses razed to the ground. In fact, when I flew over the region towards the latter end of 2003, one could see these razed villages with smoke coming out of many of them, and yet next door to them were other villages which were completely untouched, which really brought home the point that this was not generalized violence. This was a violence by one group against another group, and the targeted group was very carefully selected. That's why I came to realize that this was actually ethnic cleansing or genocide. So then we wrote all this. I wrote many of the reports myself and transmitted them to our headquarters of the UN in New York. And in New York, people were very concerned about it as they started getting these reports. But there seemed to be a great deal of reluctance to believe them. I was really, really desperate. On one hand, here was the first genocide of the 21st century being committed. And we knew what was happening. We were documenting what was going on. We had eyewitness accounts. We had reports from our own staff. So, you know, in many ways, this was one of the best known genocides ever, really. But trying to get the attention of our bosses, the bosses not just in the UN headquarters in New York, but also the Security Council countries, the big countries that make the important decisions concerning peace and security around the world, was virtually impossible. I had a lot of support on the humanitarian side of the UN, but on the political side of the UN, they simply did not want to know. So memo after memo after memo went there, right to the very top, and to which there was absolutely no reaction. I never got a reply to any of my memos documenting day after day, week after week, the atrocities that were being committed on the ground. It was like shouting down a deep well and your words disappeared into nothing. It was only later on when I finally myself went to New York in January, around January time, that I really realized why that was the case. It was that all this was really rather unwelcome news. The UN political side of the UN simply did not want to know. Their idea was that this was a humanitarian problem that had to be dealt with through aid, when it was evident to everyone else concerned that all the humanitarian aid can do is to pick up the pieces, but we had to engage politically to solve this problem, which no one was willing to do. The Security Council itself, powerful member states like the UK, like France, China, Russia, and so on, they simply did not want to know. I myself came to London, I came to Washington, D.C., I was in Paris, and spoke over those months to senior diplomats, asking them to allow the Security Council to discuss what was going on. But the reaction each time was that this was an unwelcome distraction. They did not want to interfere because it might compromise other things that were going on at that particular time, which was at that moment an imminent peace agreement between the North and the South. So I was completely frustrated that this mass murder was being committed, but the people of Darfur were being sacrificed as a trade-off against the other objectives. And that I found deeply disturbing. Then, at the beginning of December 2003, something happened which fundamentally changed the stakes. We had information from our own security people that the SLA, which is the Sudan Liberation Army, one of the fighting rebel groups, was going to launch a major attack. And so I, as the head of the UN, had a very difficult dilemma on my hands. My first responsibility was, of course, to the security and safety of our own staff, as well as the NGOs and so on who were associated with us. But if we left Darfur, then there would actually be nobody there to witness what was going on. But the reports of impending attack became more and more persistent. So in the end, in early December, we withdrew our staff from Darfur. And I then took a short break over Christmas and New Year. When I returned to my post in January, the feeling was that we could return our people to Darfur, but then the Sudan government would not allow us to return. So between December 2003 and about March 2004, we had no international staff in Darfur, and that is when the worst of the ethnic cleansing took place. It's while we were away that the murderous deeds sanctioned by Khartoum and carried out by their proteges and also the army and the air force were at their maximum height, as we now realise.
Although the full extent of the crisis in Darfur was not yet known, it was clear by this stage that thousands had already died and that hundreds of thousands had been displaced. For Mukesh, it was all starting to look hauntingly familiar.
Well, I mean, though this was just a job one was doing, to me it was very much a personal thing as well. I had been present in Rwanda immediately after the big genocide there in 1994. I'd also had close dealings with the war in Bosnia and was indeed around Srebrenica when the massacre there took place. At that time, I was a junior British government official concerned with delivering aid, but I had resolved that if ever I was in a position where I had some influence, this would not happen on my patch. So 10 years later, here I was, the head of the United Nations in the Sudan, and here I was witnessing yet another genocide. And indeed now, I was the head of the United Nations and it was happening on my patch. So having witnessed the last two genocides of the 20th century, here I was, not just witnessing, but actually presiding over the first genocide of the 21st century. That was an extremely uncomfortable feeling, something that I certainly was not prepared to tolerate. So then after I had done my round of the major Security Council countries, and after I'd been to New York yet again and argued and pleaded for greater political attention brought to Darfur, I returned to Khartoum in February, March, completely disillusioned. I had many feelings. One was a feeling of extreme frustration because the instruments at my disposal to actually make a difference were very limited. All I could do was exert influence, try to cajole, use diplomatic skills, inform people. The other feeling was, when that didn't work, was anger. I felt that the betrayal that was taking place of the people of Darfur by the mass of the international decision makers, I felt deeply frustrated, but also deeply angered by it. I felt that people at high position in institutions around the world who were making a fat living out of the world's misery, they could not be allowed to get away with the fact that they were not taking their responsibilities seriously. And that's why in the end, I was left with nothing, having exhausted all diplomatic routes, having exhausted all bureaucratic measures and done my damnedest and utmost to draw the world attention to the problem, that there was only one thing left to do, and that was to go public and to tell the world what was going on. My feeling was to really, really cause absolute maximum exposure and maximum embarrassment, not just for the perpetrators of this genocide, but also for those who had connived and who were accessories simply because they had not done their duty properly and spoken up when they could have done. One weekend then, I decided to take some time off and go to Nairobi to try and think about what I would do next. And that's when I decided I would go and speak to the BBC. The problem was that if I had said this to my bosses in New York, they would very definitely have stopped me. So I deliberately decided that I would do it without asking any permission. And I did it at a time when I knew that the office in New York and elsewhere would be closed and no one would stop me from doing this. So to speak up without permission obviously was a very serious step I was taking. I knew that it was basically the last nail in the coffin of my career, if I can put it that way. Not only was I going against the authority of the United Nations, my bosses, but I was also, what I was going to say, was going to be very directed against the government in Khartoum. But I also knew that if I did not do what I had to do, which was to speak up, I would probably never be able to live with myself for the rest of my life. But then after I made that decision, I felt much easier in my mind, and then arranged to speak to the BBC Today programme at a time that I knew that the politicians in London would be listening to tell my story. It was a sort of live interview so that it couldn't be edited. I remember walking up the steps to the BBC studios in Nairobi, and as I wandered up the steps very early morning, I was thinking to myself how far I would go, how much I would go. And then as I got into the studio and there were these reporters from BBC there, and I could hear the familiar voice of Radio 4, something that I had grown up with, I felt at home. And I was imagining to myself, as I was speaking, I was imagining as if Tony Blair might be listening to that program while he was having his morning shave. So I was trying to reach out to the decision makers there. And I was not nervous. I was just very calm. And actually, it was, you would call it, controlled fury more than anything else.
There are some pretty horrific things going on, aren't there?
In my view, this is currently the worst crisis in the world today. I'm totally shocked about what is going on in Darfur at the present time. This is ethnic cleansing. This is the world's greatest humanitarian crisis. And I don't know why the world is not doing more about it.
Dr. Mukesh Kapila, thank you very much for joining us.
The minute I had finished the programme, I had an immense sense of both calmness as well as deep foreboding. I felt calm because I had done something which in some ways I should have done earlier. I felt foreboding because I really didn't know what would happen. I was rapidly reassured because I was literally just down the steps from the studio that my phone rang, and it was the BBC World Service this time wanting to do another interview. Within about 2 minutes, having finished the BBC World Service, I had the Voice of America online, and I did the same thing. And later this afternoon, I spoke to Reuters, Agence France-Presse, and many other people from around the world. And what struck me was, we had newspapers from Peshawar and Shanghai calling, and I didn't know why they were suddenly interested in this story from those faraway places. But it encouraged me when there was a worldwide reaction and interest. Of course, New York was still asleep while this was happening, but I immediately wrote a report in New York and said what I had done, because I knew that colleagues in New York would be questioned on this, maybe even the Secretary General himself, in the noontime briefing, which takes place every day in New York. And it was only fair that they should know what I had said. There was anger amongst the bureaucrats in the Jobsworth people, of which there are plenty in the Secretariat in New York. And they were angry because what I had effectively done was completely reversed the position on that, whereas the position of the political department in the UN had been, they don't want to hear anything about this. My public remarks was forcing them and forcing the senior people there to actually come out and say something of their own. I also got a reaction from the powerful states, informally I heard, the powerful member states of the Security Council were also very annoyed with me, because when I had gone around their capitals and had been wined and dined, they had told me that they would not want Darfur to be discussed in the Security Council. It wasn't going to happen. And within a few weeks of that, they were having to reverse their position. And that reversal of position was entirely, absolutely entirely due to the fact that I had gone to the world media, and now this was world property, and the world was asking why the United Nations Security Council, the club of most powerful member states, was refusing to discuss the most serious conflict in Africa, perhaps of the two or three major conflicts in the world, and why they were not doing this.
Almost overnight, the name Darfur went from total obscurity to headline news. In the weeks to come, President Bush would begin to express concern. And in New York, the UN Security Council would start to draft a Darfur resolution. But back in Nairobi, for Mukesh, the fallout was very personal.
The reaction from my own colleagues within my office in Sudan and also in Nairobi was a shock. In fact, there was a sort of distancing from me as if I had suddenly acquired a highly infectious disease. I suppose they realized that if they were seen to be too close and supportive of me, it wouldn't be very good for their careers. So I got sort of cold-shouldered, apart from a couple of close colleagues. The reaction from the Sudan government was vitriolic. Apart from, huge personal attacks on me in the media, there were also death threats. I received a number of death threats. I was in a bit of a dilemma. Do I return back to Khartoum? I had my possessions there, not much, maybe a suitcase or two, because my family was not there with me. But obviously, I could not run away from, like a thief into the night. After all, I was the United Nations coordinator and the head of the United Nations in the Sudan. And all I'd done was spoken the truth. So I got on the plane and I returned to Khartoum. But I knew that was the end of the road. 2 weeks after that, I was out of the country. And during those 2 weeks, basically, it was quite difficult. Apart from the death threats, there was the complete isolation from anyone who really, no one wanted to really know me, whether it was in the government. That wasn't surprising. But what I think hurt me more than anything else was that my so-called colleagues and friends who were quite sort of friendly with me when I was in a position to maybe influence their careers or their jobs, now that I was probably going to be nobody, they didn't want to know me. I think the most positive thing I had was I had hundreds of emails from around the world, hundreds and hundreds of emails. My system was clogged up. These were ordinary people just writing in, saying thanks and commending me and so on. But of these hundreds of emails, the ones that I appreciated most were from the Sudanese themselves. Many Sudanese from within the country and from the diaspora wrote in. I remember one email which said, "Thank you for speaking up. We were hopeless and you have given us hope." Another email said, "We had no voice and you have given us a voice. God bless you." And, I needed all the blessings I could get. I can tell you that.
Although there was still almost a year left of his Sudan assignment, Mukesh knew that it was not a question of if, but rather when he would be recalled from his position. In the event, within just 2 weeks, he was gone for good.
No one has ever terminated my contract or said anything negative in writing from the UN establishment. These things are done in a more gentlemanly fashion. It's phone calls, discussions take place. It's basically a discussion that perhaps a new type of approach was needed in the future, that there was going to be a peace agreement and perhaps a new team had to come in. So it's all done in terms of having understandings. But whether it's said politely to you or whether someone stabs you in the back, they amount to the same thing. You're not welcome anymore and that you should leave. I knew I was going to leave, and I wanted, before leaving, to make sure that there was no doubt left in the minds of anybody, and certainly for the history, that the United Nations and the most important countries in the world, in whose hands lie the welfare of our globe, were unaware of what was going on in Darfur or the magnitude of what was going on in Darfur. That no one could argue in the future that they did not know. Because you remember, that was one of the alibis used in Srebrenica, that was one of the alibis used in Rwanda, and I wanted to make sure that there were no excuses left. So I wrote a memorandum which basically said that what was going on in Darfur was ethnic cleansing, that the government of Sudan was responsible, that the ethnic cleansing was on a par with Rwanda in terms of the type of violence being committed. So I sent off this memo, which was addressed to the chief of staff of the Secretary General, asking his attention to be drawn to this matter. I got no reaction at all, either then or at any time up to this day. And then I think that was basically the end of the road as I boarded my plane out of the country onto my Lufthansa flight out. There was no one to see me off apart from one or two personal friends. A sharp contrast to a year earlier when I had arrived in the country and I'd been met with a huge delegation from the Sudan government and all the United Nations team there, scores of people, great protocol, limousines, cars, flags flying. But when I left, it was just on my own with a suitcase.
As Mukesh boarded his flight, the UN Security Council and the Secretary General were both preparing statements on Darfur. In the years that followed, peace negotiations came and went. Ceasefires were agreed and broken. Resolutions were passed and the conflict continued. By the end of 2006, 200,000 had been killed and 2 million others were living in camps. Sudan continues to resist the deployment of UN peacekeepers.
In my view, if we, the international community, including the powerful nations of the world, had intervened earlier on in 2003, we would still have had violence and many people would have been killed, but I'm sure it would have been much less, and maybe we would not have been talking about genocide now. The international system is full of good statements. There's a convention against genocide and there are crimes against humanity. We have the International Criminal Court and such like. And these are all important building blocks for a more peaceful, secure and just world. Unfortunately, the intentions and the tools at our disposal, they are not used because they're in the hands of feeble-minded people. Feeble-minded people who occupy high office, who are more interested in preserving their own position and their fat salaries and looking to the next job than in exercising the privilege of office to actually make a difference. So in my view, the failure in Darfur is simply is not a failure of the fact that government would not listen and so on. That could be expected. But it's a failure of people not doing their jobs, people who are in trustful and sacred positions of international governance. And, you know, come to think about it, the mass murder has been committed in Darfur in the 21st century, and yet not a single person, not a single official, either in the United Nations Secretariat at the political side or in any of the foreign offices of London or Paris or wherever has lost their jobs about it. So there is no accountability in this.
Today, Mukesh Kapila lives with his family in Geneva, where he holds a senior position at a non-governmental organisation.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/Radio 1.